This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. How do you recognize wisdom? What would you do to cultivate wisdom in your own life? Ken Sharp has looked at these questions and more. He is the co-author with Barry Schwartz of the new book, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. In this book, the authors contend that practical wisdom is the missing ingredient in our social and political life. Ken Sharp is professor of political science at Swarthmore College, specializing in political philosophy, public policy, and U.S. foreign policy. Ken Sharp, welcome to KBOO.
Nice to be here, Kathleen.
How did you become interested in this idea of practical wisdom?
We became interested in this from a couple of different directions. One was from our students teaching courses in ethics to Swarthmore students who were always wondering why this was important in their own lives, particularly if you're teaching Plato or Aristotle or some of the more ancient political theorists. They're fairly impatient if they don't see the connection. And one of the things we always liked about particularly Aristotle was that his notion of practical wisdom or really good judgment in ethical life was something we thought connected to the everyday lives of students. But I think the other piece was watching the bad judgment all around us, whether it was amongst our colleagues or amongst professionals like doctors or lawyers or amongst would-be statesmen, seeing bad judgment, seeing examples of good judgment, and hearing nobody ever talk about wisdom or judgment made us think this old idea that Aristotle had about the importance of practical wisdom, which I think the Greek word he used for that was phronesis, began to ring true with us. So we decided we would work it into our courses, and the courses led to lectures, and the lectures led to the Practical Wisdom book.
Is there anything more you want to say about what exactly it is? We've touched on Aristotle, but talk a little bit more about what it is.
We think of it as the kind of judgment that everyone from parents to doctors to lawyers to friends need to make the everyday decisions in their lives about social relationships, about when and how to be honest, when and how to be fair, when and how to be patient. I think one of the things that has allowed us to understand it best is by understanding what it isn't. Most of the time when people talk about ethics and social relations, they're usually talking about rules. So they're talking about the do unto others rule or Kant's categorical imperative of treat everybody as if your action could be universalized, or the utilitarian rule, do the greatest good for the greatest number, or the Ten Commandments. And one of the things that is problematic about rules is that when you actually have to act in a particular circumstance with a particular person, there's no rule for how to apply that rule. There's no rule for telling you what to do in a particular context. And also, rules often conflict with each other. If one of the examples that the students in our classes used to bring up would be the examples of friendship, of the two cardinal rules of friendship. One is always be honest, and the other is always be kind. So one of the students said, well, so what happens when you go to pick up your date and she walks out the door and she's dressed to the nines and she says, how do I look? And you actually think she doesn't look so great. And you've got these two rules in your head. Be honest, be kind. Well, what do you do? Well, what you do actually depends on the situation. It depends on what kind of day she had. It depends on the kind of party you're going to. It depends on the nature of your relationship. You may want to be one or the other, or you may want to balance it. It may depend on what you think other people will say about how she looks when you go to where you're going. So sometimes being the kind thing to do may be to be honest. It may depend on what kind of day you've had, what kind of day she had, what else is in the closet. You've got to balance the honesty and the kindness. So simply having the rules isn't going to help you figure out what to do with this friend in this kind of circumstance. That takes practical wisdom. And if we think about the decisions that we make or that professionals make or that most people around us make in their everyday lives, that kind of problem of what do you do in this context with this person is a common everyday problem. It happens hundreds of times every day. And you need practical wisdom, which you only learn really through experience, to figure out what to do and how to do it.
There are moral skills, I guess you call them, that are part of this whole construct of practical wisdom. Can you talk about, I'm thinking of things like empathy and other qualities. Can you talk about those and how they contribute to this idea of practical wisdom?
Sure. That's a really good question. I think the idea that having good judgment or practical wisdom actually demands a kind of moral skill. At some level, it's an obvious idea, but for Barry Schwartz and I, it was a real breakthrough to actually think about it as a skill, something like the skill a craftsman has in making her jewelry, or it could be in blacksmithing, or in any kind of craft. It's something that you learn how to do depending on the materials that you have in front of you. So empathy, for example, demands good listening skills. And good listening skills demands knowing when to be quiet and when to talk and how to talk. It demands the skill of reading body language, for example. It demands the skill of how to phrase things to somebody else. There are lots of skills that even the simple act of good listening demands. And if you think about good listening, which is at the heart of so many of our social relationships, you can begin to get a sense, at least, of why it demands a certain kind of skill. Knowing the right thing to do in the sense of, well, I should say such and such to so and so, doesn't tell you how to say it. This might be a good point to bring up now. Another thing that we learned from reading the ancients that I think was so important, particularly Aristotle, was that when he thought about ethics, it wasn't just about thinking the right thing, getting the right answer on an ethics test, being a judge from a distance. It was about doing the right thing. It was about acting. It was about figuring out, how am I to act in this situation? Not how should have Kathleen have acted in that situation. It's about me and how I need to act. So that means that practical wisdom also demands things like patience, like courage, like self-control, like care, like gentleness. And all of those things are things that you need to be skillful at. If you're a caring person, you have the disposition to care, but you don't know how to care, you can cause extraordinary havoc. It's like the poverty of good intentions. So it demands caring skills, it demands listening skills, it demands knowing how and when to be committed. And those kinds of skills, which we're referring to in the book as moral skills, they can be learned, and they're important to learn. So it's not just about having the right feeling, which is also important, but the skill to actually act in a particular circumstance.
You mentioned rules, and you say that our traditional approach, and now I'm kind of switching a little bit to institutional change, because a lot of the book talks about people in institutions and how they act. And a lot of the traditional approach to institutional change is to make rules and offer smart incentives. And so we've talked about some of the limits to the rules. I guess, what are some of the limits to the incentive issue?
The way you put it, I think, is really good. When we think about getting people to behave properly in society, we usually reach for some form of carrot or some form of stick, some form of incentive. We'll pay you more, we'll reward you more, we'll give you a gold star if you do such and such, or some sort of rule, we'll punish you for not doing something. And you really can't have any organizations functioning in society without some set of rules and incentives. But if you just act on those rules and incentives, you're not going to get the kind of fine-tuning you need to get people to do the right thing. There are a couple of classic examples that really struck us as we started doing research for the book. One were scripted curricula that are used in many elementary and high schools, for example, to teach reading. One example we have was a Chicago school teacher. I think her name was Mrs. Jabari. And there she is on day 53 of the school year, reading on a page of her script that says day 53, and she's teaching the kids the word B for bath. And she has 60 or 70 lines of script, which she must go through with these kids in order to teach them the letter B. And she's got consultants and administrators that come in and out of her class to make sure that she's following that script, and she's following it on the day she's supposed to. And that's all designed so that the students can pass a particular standardized test. Well, she needs more than that script reading to be able to do that. She actually needs to be able to figure out what Sarah needs or what Alice needs at a particular time in that class. If somebody's falling behind, if someone has special needs in the class, if the kids aren't getting it, she needs to switch. And she needs the judgment to know how to make that switch. And she needs to know how fast to move with some students and how slow to move with other students. So getting her to follow that script, the kind of institutional solution to getting everybody to read to pass the test, often not only undermines the education of the kids, but undermines the judgment of the Mrs. Jabaris, who don't have a chance to learn through trial and error how to do that. So she becomes less of a wise teacher and less of a good teacher, and institutionally brings down the whole quality of teaching. So that would be an example inside an institution. You want an incentive
yeah,
example?
Yeah, that'd be great.
We could use an incentive example. Actually, you could also use the school system. There was a school in Texas that we studied, and a teacher called Mrs. Dewey, who'd been teaching for years, was really a pro at teaching. The school itself wasn't up to the high level that the principal wanted to get it in terms of the state standardized tests. So they brought in consultants, and Mrs. Dewey sits down at a meeting with these consultants, in which all the students at the school are divided into three groups by the consultant. The green group, kids that are going to have no trouble passing the standardized exam. And the red group, the kids that are never going to make it because they've got foreign language problems, they've come into the school too late, they're special needs kids. And then there are the orange students, or what they call, the consultant calls, the bubble kids, which are the kids that are just a few points away getting that exam right and putting the school over the top. So there's an incentive system that's set up in the school, a system of rewards, of status, of reputation, that all the teachers are trying to work on in order to get their school and get their classes up. It's not really punishments, but it's an incentive. And the incentive leads the consultant to advise the teachers to forget about the green kids and forget about the red kids and just work on the yellow kids, just work on the bubble kids. And Mrs. Dewey is beside herself because she doesn't just want to work on those six or seven students, which would get the test scores up and would be get her reputation in the school up. That for her isn't what good teaching is. But institutionally, you've built in incentives to get her to do that kind of action. Merit pay often has that effect on doctors. You can actually incentivize doctors to do too little or to do too much. But it's very difficult to incentivize doctors to do exactly the right thing. If you start providing them incentives for denying care or for following a particular practice, that might not be the practice that a certain patient needs at that particular moment. So you get doctors or you get teachers to start thinking about rewards, to start thinking about money, and you can effectively get them to do that. But what they ought to be thinking about is what good education or what good healthcare or what good doctoring is for this particular student or this particular patient. If you get them to think about how it is that they can make more money or get more status or get more glory, you're incentivizing them in the wrong way, and you're actually undermining the kind of judgment that they need to do the right thing.
I'm speaking with Ken Sharp. We're talking about the book that he co-authored with Barry Schwartz. It's called Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about this situation and how it relates to the structure of our society in a way, because we had a guest on a few months ago. She was a professor and author, and she wrote a book called The Moral Underground, How Ordinary People Subvert an Unfair Economy, and it had some similarities to your ideas of the canny outlaws and system changers. But both of the books are trying to find ways, it seems to me, to operate in a society that's structured unfairly. So I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
One way you can think about this, Kathleen, is the nothing can be done kind of frame, that incentives are part of any market system. And if under a market system or under a capitalist system, incentives are going to be built in. So you're going to design healthcare or education or law under with billable hours or with some kind of incentives. The more you bring the market in, the more you're going to destroy people's good judgment. Or you could think about the problem as a problem of states and bureaucracy, too many rules, that the solution is if a certain kind of rule doesn't work, we're going to have another rule. If bankers are misbehaving, if they're evading the law, another law will work. Or if a particular set of incentives doesn't work, we'll give them a better set of incentives. So in the banking system, for example, one way we thought 8 or 10 years ago that we could get bankers to behave better was to tie their income to the price of the stock. So they would have the incentive to improve the price of the stock of their bank, or it could be of a corporation, not just bankers. Well, they figured out pretty quickly that there were ways that they could improve or jack up the price of the stock that had nothing to do with the long-term health of the corporation, let alone the long-term health of the economy. So using those incentives and using those rules, in a way you could say, well, that's just part of a system of that depends on big bureaucracies and that depends on markets. But what we found when we wrote the book is that there are all sorts of interstices right here in the United States of people who are either finding ways to do the right thing despite the rules and incentives. Those would be like the canny outlaws or the moral underground that you were referring to. And even more interesting for us were people who were actually trying to change the institutions that they were working in, even though they were working inside this system. So we were particularly fascinated, for example, by the growth since the 1970s of community banks inside the United States, of either community banks or local credit unions, banks that have gotten together with local communities to rebuild inner cities, to provide mortgages at decent rates, not at predatory rates, that actually care about their clients. They don't make as much money as IndyMac, for example, which figured out a way that they could not care at all about the clients that they worked with. But they're able to make a profit, and they're able to do the right thing because you've got people at the heads of those banks that see ways that you can bring business and community development together. Mm-hmm. And then they hire people that have that aim, and they train them to use their good judgment about how to make loans to people who may not have a lot of money, how to build education into that loaning system so that the men and women who make those loans, whether they're small businesses or homeowners, can pay them back. So it's not impossible to do. You can see that actually in law firms. We studied one law firm in Buffalo, and one of the partners, a fellow named Chris Schultz, was able to design a quite profitable corporate law firm in which he practically eliminated the ill effects that billable hours have on how lawyers act. It wasn't that they didn't keep track of billable hours, but the only one that knew what the billable hours were was Chris Schultz, who was the head of the firm. People weren't paid by their billable hours. And as a matter of fact, he, instead of encouraging simply pro bono work in the spare time of the lawyers, he built in community service as part of the work that the lawyers did. And the lawyers knew that whether they were getting low income from doing community service or high income from working on real estate deals, that they were going to be paid more or less the same. And you could actually find highly qualified, highly dedicated lawyers that were willing to work with each other in a firm like that in order to do good as well as doing well inside the firm. You can find that in hospitals and medical programs too. We looked at a program in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Cambridge Health Alliance, in which the doctors there who were concerned about the moral erosion of their students in medical school were able to totally redesign the healthcare program and the training of the third and fourth year students so that instead of whizzing them around at 2 to 3 minute intervals following an attending physician or a chief resident on the hospital floor, they spent part of each day in a kind of mentorship relationship with a doctor in a clinic. And they had that same doctor every Monday or every Tuesday or every Wednesday in OBGYN or internal medicine for the whole year. They were given their own patients. Each was assigned 15 patients, which they were in charge of, along with the help of that doctor. They would follow those patients whenever they came into the hospital, no matter what department they came in. They got a really intensive knowledge, which helped actually teach them empathy, not because they were getting lectures in empathy, but because the system was redesigned so that they had the time and so that they had the modeling and mentoring of doctors who were empathetic, so that the decline of empathy and the moral erosion actually disappeared inside the system. So in each of these places, you had these, we call them system changers, who said, okay, instead of setting up a system so you have a canny outlaw that's doing good or doing right in spite of the system, could we set up a system which actually encourages people to learn judgment and encourages them to aim at the right thing? And it was fascinating to us, these interstices where people could actually do it. And people loved it. The professionals that we talked to hated being in these systems where they couldn't do the right thing or where they were squeezed for time. They were always looking for ways out of that. But it was often very hard for them to do it as individuals. So one of the things that we do in the book is look at a number of examples of these system changers, hoping that maybe will model for other people the kinds of things that can be done at the institutional level, despite the forces of bureaucracy and markets that undermine wisdom and judgment.
Yeah, I was encouraged to see that the last section of your book is about sources of hope. How do you nurture practical wisdom in institutions? Besides the specific programs, which sound wonderful, what are ways that just as a society we can nurture this kind of thinking?
I think one of the conclusions we came to, Kathleen, was that it's hard to think about it as a society. But I guess it depends on what we mean by as a society. Often when I use that word, maybe I'm using it differently than you, I end up thinking, well, what kind of policy could we have? What could we do at that national level that would change this? And there are some things you could do at the national level. I mean, if you had legislation, for example, that better supported community banking, if you had legislation that encouraged local banking practices or that prevented predatory banking, I think that would be of help. I think if you had educational legislation that encouraged schools to figure out how they themselves could up the reading requirements of their students instead of demanding state standardized tests, or if you had standardized tests, not demand scripted curricula, give the teachers the encouragement and permission to figure out how to do it themselves, as opposed to having a consultant or a publishing house impose a solution. I think that would open up possibilities. So I don't want to deny the importance of policy. But ultimately, it's going to be the people on the ground and institutions getting together. There was an interesting article about Brockton High in Massachusetts that was published in a number of newspapers, including The Times, a few months ago. This is one of the biggest high schools in Massachusetts. It's got 41 students. It had the lowest, among the lowest grades on the standardized tests in the state. And the state was threatening in the late 1990s to fail about 750 seniors every year unless the school brought up its the reading scores. But what the teachers did there was really interesting. They didn't import some kind of a standardized script. They got together first in small groups and then larger groups, and they said, look, we've got to solve this problem ourselves. They actually set up weekend meetings with small groups. The head of the English department was the brains behind this. They came up with the idea that if every class taught students writing as part, whether it was gym class or home economics, whatever class, or math class, if everybody did writing part of the day, this could up the writing scores incredibly. The other teachers were very skeptical. They got some teachers to go along with a pilot program. In 1 year, the grades increased dramatically. Almost all the teachers bought into the program. was totally voluntary, but they saw that there was a solution that they could put together themselves. And what the article in the New York Times was about was that after about 8 or 9 years, Brockton High was in the top 90% of Massachusetts. I think those are the kinds of examples that we find most inspiring, because there are ways that we can do it ourselves and not just wait for someone else to do it for us.
Also, complete structural change is sort of overwhelming.
It's absolutely overwhelming. When you think about problems at that level, you just want to go home and close your door and listen to music. But when you're actually working in an institution, you want to work in an institution that encourages you to do the right thing in the right way. That makes you work better, and it also makes you happier, frankly, at work. And one of the reasons why we wrote the book was to encourage people to have those kinds of conversations. So it's not a how-to book, because it's not a formula. One of the essences of practical wisdom is that what it means depends on the kind of practice that you're in, whether it's teaching and what kind of teaching and what kind of students you have. And it depends on a community of people that can have a dialogue and figure out what is it that they can do to change the institutional structures to make their work more successful. And our argument is that more successful work is going to be work in which you actually educate people to exercise better judgment, to figure out what to do in this particular context with your client, your students, your patients, and frankly, in your own lives with your friends and with your kids.
I'm speaking with Ken Sharp. We've been talking about his new book he co-authored with Barry Schwartz, Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Is there anything that we have missed, Ken, or an important point that you would like to say in concluding this interview?
I think maybe the only point I'd make, Kathleen, is something that is important to understand about ethical choice and about wisdom. We often think about doing the right thing as something that we're doing against our will, that, oh, we'll do it, but it will make us unhappy to do it. We'll do it because it's moral, because we're forced to do it. But two of the core ingredients, we think, for being happy, and it's what a lot of the research shows, is having good relationships with people and having meaningful work. And one of the arguments we make at the end of the book is that both of those things, doing meaningful work and having good relationships, demands exercising practical wisdom. You can't do those things unless you learn the judgment to do them well. So in that sense, acting wisely isn't just something for sages. It's something that we all need and we all actually want, and we can all learn. And if we learn it, we can have better relationships, and we can also have more meaningful work. And in the end, that will make us happy. And that's a good motivation for learning it, not because we have to, but because we want to.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us, Ken Sharp. Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me in.
And tell people again, the title of the book is Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.